decades ago. Crack Commander Yoon was sent to prison by a military court for a crime they didn't commit. These men promptly escaped from a maximum security stockade to the Los Angeles underground. Today, still wanted by the government, they survive as soldiers of fortune. If you have a problem, if no one else can help, and if you can find them, maybe you can hire the A-Team. Welcome to Twipcast, episode 38, V-Cast! This time we will be discussing the first of many 1980s TV show remakes, V. Rest assured, we'll discuss A-Team in the very near future. I would like to introduce you to James Caswell, executive producer of Twipcast, greatest American hero, a misfit of science, and a true Knight Rider.
And he's Doug Zeitlin, co-executive producer of Twerps, an admitted member of the Diana Wet Dream Club. The worst part is that he preferred her in her lizard form. Don't ask him what he wanted to do with the forked tongue.
Well, Jim, in all fairness, my dream was a three-way with me, Diana, and Lydia. Well, in the spirit of Bionicast and Kitcast, today we are going to feature a remake that probably is not going to make it to the second season.
Well, we are officially giving it our kiss of death by featuring it. But it was a favorite series back in the day, and we figure the least we can do is pay homage to it before it dies a horrible and miserable ratings death.
Yes, but as I stated in the opening today, this is just the beginning of revisits to the 1980s.
We've said it multiple times in the past, Doug, but do you get the feeling that there are no more original thoughts in Hollywood?
I suppose that you could argue that all seven original scripts were actually written by Shakespeare, and he probably ripped them off from the Greeks.
Or we could use one of Avery's favorite lines and say that those who fail to learn from history
are doomed to repeat it. And then, in the case of the remakes that have gone on so far, they were definitely doomed.
Which is a shame, because I really did enjoy the new Bionic Woman, and I really did enjoy the new Knight Rider. It's just that we probably, like the people who came up with the idea of revisiting these shows, had fond memories of the original and enjoyed the opportunity to pay tribute to them.
I think you've hit the nail right on the head here. It is really the newest round of Hollywood or television or whatever you want to call them, producers, directors, writers, grew up and they've watched these 1980s television shows first run as children.
Much like we did.
And now they're giving them a bastard rebirth.
And the production companies are more than happy to let them because they're hoping to get another Battlestar Galactica on their hands.
I personally would argue that Battlestar Galactica is, well, enjoyable, highly overrated, but that didn't keep it from being a massive success, so I guess that's just my personal thoughts.
And I feel as though it actually points to what is causing these shows to fail. They are looking for Battlestar Galactica-type results without taking into consideration the fact that part of the reason why Battlestar Galactica was considered such a success was because it was on the Sci-Fi Network, and you don't need huge numbers for a show to be considered a success on a cable channel. The exact same numbers that would be considered a success on cable are considered failures on broadcast television.
And I think there's actually a second point that people have missed. When you look at a show like Battlestar Galactica from the 80s, Battlestar Galactica is one of the most successful television shows, drawing in one of the biggest ratings that the network had ever had. The problem was, the network was paying more for that show than it was paying for any other show on the network. So, in realistic terms, that's why we went from a successful Battlestar Galactica to the forbidden to mention Galactica 1980, was to reduce the cost of the show. You take a highly successful show like Battlestar Galactica, you can reintroduce it and have a second very highly rated television show. When you take something which is a low ratings tank job like V, what are you expecting when you redo it?
Now, keep in mind that V actually had three starts back in the 80s. When it came out as the original miniseries by Kenneth Johnson, it aired May 1st and 2nd in 1983, and it was a blockbuster hit. It was one of the highest rated shows in history at that point for that time of the year. Everybody seemed to watch V. Plus, it was written by Kenneth Johnson, who had several successful hits under his belt at the time. He had done The Incredible Hulk with Bill Bixby. He had done The $6 Million Man. He had done Bionic Woman. He would go on to do Alien Nation. So you have a very successful showrunner that gets very successful ratings for the miniseries, and it is the talk of the town.
No, I want to add something else. Again, we're talking nearly 30 years ago. There was no such thing as a winter season or a summer television season the way cable networks have now. Essentially, once television shows went off the air,
you were in repeats for the rest of the summer.
And there were really only three networks at the time. You could watch CBS repeats, NBC repeats, or ABC repeats. When you have a miniseries like V, that was the talk of the town. That was, oh my gosh, there is something new on the television.
And while it's at the very beginning of the May sweeps, it was still something brand new. Science fiction at the time was space battles and Star Trek and things of that nature. V brought it back to Earth and put it in present day and gave it a real now threat feel to it, which was something that wasn't that common in science fiction on television at that point.
Well, again, just going into science fiction, one of the things that sci-fi is used very well for is allegory. You're going to put something in a science fiction context, which actually has a real background. One of my favorite examples of this is The Crucible. Technically, it's not science fiction, but it still works in this context. So you've got a play written about the Salem witch trials in the 1600s, and it's talking about giving up your neighbors, and if you don't admit that you're a witch, we're going to blacklist you, and all sorts of things that were happening in the 1950s when this play was written. But they were actually happening in Washington with McCarthy telling people, who is a red? Who in Hollywood is a communist? We're going to blacklist you if you don't tell us.
And we expect you to name every single person that you know, whether you think that they're a communist or not, just so that we can continue our hunts.
And so you have art imitating life. We're using this allegory of one situation to talk about another situation. And that's exactly what V did. V said, here we are in modern day, and we have aliens, and we're going to use this setting to discuss World War II. So let's talk a little bit about the basic premise of the show.
The original V miniseries was about a fleet of alien ships led by the very charismatic Diana, who visits Earth looking to exchange technology for resources. They claim that their home planet has run out of natural resources like water, and they are willing to trade their advanced technology, their advanced cures, for something that we take for granted. Sounds like a very cushy exchange. And the politicians are more than happy to jump on the bandwagon and say, yeah, that sounds great. Let's do this. It's soon revealed, though, that the aliens are not what they appear to be, and they look to take over the Earth. One of the other resources that they're short on is food, and we humans look kind of tasty to them. A human resistance forms and starts to fight back, led by reporter Mike Donovan and scientist Julie Parrish. Very reminiscent of the European underground that not only fought against the Nazis every opportunity that they got, but also would smuggle Jews out of conquered territory to safety.
The actual allegory was very thinly veiled, and they used characters who supposedly spent time in the concentration camps. One of the main characters' grandparent was trying to explain to him, this is what happened in Germany, this is what's happening now in America, you can't let this happen.
The alien soldiers had a very stormtrooper-esque feel to them, and by stormtrooper I mean both the Nazi party and the Imperial stormtrooper feel. They all had red uniforms that matched with a unifying symbol on them. Most of them wore black, almost motorcycle helmets, so that they had a very unified look to them. Even the alien symbol, if you looked at it carefully enough, had a very swastika-esque look to it.
I don't want to say that they were trying to hit us over the head with a clue by four, but they weren't trying to hide what they were doing either.
More like a clue by two.
Exactly. Would you like to talk a little bit about your memories of the original airing, Jim?
I have very distinctive memories of watching this the first time. At the time, I was 13 years old, and my parents had actually gone out for the evening. I was home alone watching it, and I will never forget that it was right in the middle of watching the show, and one of the aliens had literally just peeled their skin off to reveal that they were a lizard underneath, and I heard a noise back in the back of the house where my parents' bedroom was. It scared the pee out of me, because here I am watching this TV show that was one of the closest things to horror available on TV at the time, with these scary alien creatures, and I'm hearing noises from the back room. Well, I managed to build up the courage to go and check it out, and come to find out my dad had his radio set on a timer, and it had clicked on, and there was a talk show going on, but I will never forget the fact that it just scared the livid bejesus out of me.
Oh, that's pretty funny. For me, I just remember thinking how rare television science fiction was at the time, and having to beg, borrow, and steal to get money for Betamax videotapes.
Yes, folks, he said Betamax.
Yeah, my family was on the losing side of the format wars, but I was able to get enough Betamax video to record the entire miniseries. And then my 3-year-old sister decided that she was going to record Strawberry Shortcake over this. I'm not bitter, I just want her to replace it.
But she has made it to adulthood, so you didn't kill her, so at least you got that going for you.
I keep thinking that every year she's going to replace it.
Nah.
I think it's interesting looking back at this, the 1980s, because we had several actors that were in this series that, although they were somewhat known, that they would go on actually to fame after this.
Well, fame for the 80s, but yes. We had people like Mark Singer, who played Mike Donovan, who later went on to play Beastmaster.
Beastmaster the movie, not Beastmaster the television show, but Beastmaster the movie is one of my favorite 80s movies.
Yes, I completely agree. We had Faye Grant, who had been on Greatest American Hero before this, but this was kind of a breakout for her, and she went on to do several genre-related things. You had Jane Badler, who really never became known for anything but playing Diana.
Oh, that's not entirely true. She achieved momentary infamy during the reboot of the Mission Impossible television series as being the only Mission Impossible agent to actually die in an episode.
Like I said, she was best known for playing Diana in V. And then you had a real unknown actor, nobody had ever heard of him before this point, who played a bumbling alien who ended up working with the Resistance. The actor's name was Robert Englund. Most listeners will probably know him better as Freddy Krueger.
The irony being, he actually got to know his real face in V when he was supposed to be an alien, and he never got to see his real face when he was Freddy Krueger. But of course, this particular miniseries just blew the ratings out of the air, and the networks wanted more.
They desperately wanted more. They thought, if a miniseries could do this well, what kind of ratings would a regular series bring in? But they weren't quite ready to commit to a full season of V, because they didn't quite know if this was just a fluke, or if this was something that was actually going to take off. So they commissioned another miniseries to air 1 year later, on May 6th through 8th, 1984, called V, The Final Battle.
All right, Jim, why don't you tell us a little bit about this miniseries?
Diana's still around, but she proved herself to be incapable of taking care of these rebels, so they sent in a new leader. The Resistance is joined by Ham Tyler, who is played by Michael Ironside, and they kind of amp everything up to the next level. Ham Tyler is a professional mercenary, and they're in the Los Angeles area, and they needed help, and they knew who to call.
Dun, 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 dun.
So they take a bit more of a militaristic slash terroristic attitude towards fighting against the aliens. Meanwhile, spoiled brat Robin, who was a character introduced in the first miniseries, who had an affair with one of the aliens, gives birth to her half-breed baby, and all the Star Child mess begins.
I don't even know how to comment on the Star Child, because the Star Child was one thing in the miniseries, something completely different in the series, and overall was just a hot mess.
One of the big problems that V, The Final Battle had was that some of the newness of the storyline, the idea of aliens coming, trying to take over the world, it wore off. It wasn't as new and invigorating as it was a year ago. The other problem was that Kenneth Johnson didn't write this one by himself. He had 4 other people contributing to the script.
The way I read that is Kenneth Johnson wrote his script and then the network tore it to shreds.
Probably a pretty good chance of it. So the original creator, the person who had the dream of the story, didn't have sole creative control anymore. You had other people coming on in. I have to believe that that's where the Star Child thing came in. That had to have been somebody else's brainchild, because that was so far off the beaten path of what was established within the first miniseries. Yes, Kenneth Johnson did put into the original miniseries the fact that the visitors were trying to breed with the humans, and Robin was a big enough idiot and slut that it worked, but I don't know that going in the direction of this child being the savior of 2 races ever really fell into any part of his plan. I don't know. I don't know Kenneth Johnson personally, unfortunately, for him.
I agree with you. I think that as a science fiction plot line, that there was a lot. I mean, I can see them using this character rather than making it a science fiction star child with special powers, but just saying a rally point or a hero that both the humans and the visitors could look to and say, look, we can coexist. Well, skipping ahead, Kenneth Johnson recently wrote a book that's a direct sequel to V, the miniseries, and kind of ignores everything else. And he does talk a lot about the human and alien crossbreeding and the fact that these are considered second-class citizens, that neither the humans nor the aliens actually accept them. I don't know if that's what he was thinking in the 1980s or not.
But given the fact that none of them are star children, there's a pretty good chance that he didn't plan on going in that direction either.
I would agree with that, 100%.
Now, that's not to say that V, the Final Battle, was a failure or anything of that nature. In fact, it still did incredibly well in the ratings. Enough to show NBC that, no, it wasn't a fluke. People really were interested in this story, which is what caused them to go on ahead and greenlight a series. V, the series, aired October 6th, 1984, a mere 5 months after the second miniseries. Unfortunately, now Kenneth Johnson had even less to do with the show, and boy, could you tell.
I would say this show less resembles V, the miniseries, and more resembles brown floating logs in my toilet. This was more like V, the series, based off the miniseries, and we're going to take the points we like and throw away the ones that we don't, and we'll just create new stuff. And the way I spell stuff is S-H-I-T.
In my opinion, this was a perfect example of taking a good thing too far and just utterly destroying it. It's like Galactica 1980.
As far as its closeness and relevance to the original, yeah, I would agree with that. Inconvenient storylines were just ignored, even within the internal continuity of the television show. They would say in one episode, this is a fact, and then they would just ignore it in a future episode.
This show had about the same level of continuity as The Simpsons. It has it when it wants it, otherwise it completely ignores it.
They didn't know what they wanted to do. At one point, they bring in this actor, Frank Ashmore, play a fifth column visitor named Martin. He's an incredibly popular character. He's somebody that the fans can really relate to. He's one of the high points of the series. So what do, Jim?
They kill him off.
Well, at least they were smart enough to realize that that was a bad idea. So they created his evil twin, Philip.
Which, the idea of taking these visitors who wear human masks and taking the mask that one lizard wore and putting it onto another lizard, I don't have a problem with that. The fact that they said the two lizards are twin brothers, why? Why go with the stereotypical evil twin to that degree?
There wasn't a lot that was really well thought out in this TV show, unfortunately. But yes, they bring in the evil twin brother, who then gets convinced to join the Resistance also.
The show ended on a cliffhanger, but no one actually cared what was left to happen when it got canceled after 13 episodes.
It wasn't that much of a cliffhanger. It ended with the Star Child, who has magical powers. We don't know what any of the magical powers are, so it really doesn't matter that it looked like the alien leader and the Star Child were about to get blown to bits, because she has magic powers. Unexplainable, unobtainable magic powers, so you can use any excuse at all. Oh, she traveled in time. Oh, she can create a force field. She's magic!
Magical powers that changed from week to week. See that whole, they didn't stick to any type of continuity we mentioned earlier.
So, ostensibly, it was a cliffhanger, but it wasn't one that actually looked like anybody was in mortal peril, if you had been paying attention.
Oh, and did we mention that the Star Child had growth hormone problems, that from the time that she was born to a couple of weeks later, she aged 7 years, and then at the beginning of the show, she entered into this cocoon status type thing and turned it into this hot 18-year-old blonde?
Which actually led to these really awkward moments where there were guys hitting on her and trying to kiss her and do the hot 18-year-old who was probably only 3-4 months old.
And the fact that she got into competitions with her mother over love interests. It's just...
it was awkward.
Things that make you go, ew. Not well conceived. And then there was her character. So the show went off the air March 22nd, 1985. And it looked as though that was probably the end of V. Let's face facts. It was the end of V for almost 25 years.
So if you're wondering about the 2009 reimagining by Scott Peters, I have to imagine that he, again, is like me and Jim, fondly remembers the really good points of V. The first miniseries is awesome. Second miniseries is good. Not so good as the first one, but there's still really good stuff in it. And in my imagination, that's what Scott Peters is remembering when he's reimagining V for a modern audience.
This is definitely a reimagining. This is not a sequel. It's not a extended spinoff. It's got a basic premise and a title in common with this old TV show. And that's really about it.
I agree completely. Scott Peters really incorporates the Visitor storyline into a post-9/11 mentality. And much the way the first miniseries back in the 80s really dealt with a lot of the subjects left over from the Second World War, in this modern era, we're talking about the mentality of, are they resistance fighters or are they terrorists?
Are the Visitors saviors or terrorists? Who do you trust? Can you trust the government? Can you trust the people who are saying that they're just here to help you? A lot of these questions that are still present even today.
And I think that's a great point. I believe there are conspiracies out there, and I believe that there are cover-ups out there. The characters on V, there are some people who believe crazy theories like that.
Yeah, you have the people who, for all intents and purposes, are nut jobs. You have the people who, in all appearances, are nut jobs who turn out to be absolutely correct. You have the people who are working for the government who don't know what's really going on. You have the people who work for the government who do know exactly what's going on and are covering it up. You have all of these things stirring together in the background, and it makes for a much more psychological thriller environment than the black and white, if they have lizard skin, they're bad guys. If they're working with the lizards, they're bad guys. If you're fighting against the lizards, you're good guys. The original show is very black and white, and this one has a lot more gray involved in it.
It's really a lot more of an adult show. This is not your dad's V. I would say, though, that the one thing that makes me the most angry about this entire television show is that they stole Elizabeth Mitchell from Lost. I miss you, Juliet.
Like I said, it does have the basic ingredients similar to the original show. This time around, the Visitors are led by a very charismatic Anna, who, while Diana was attractive, she was a little bit off-putting. Anna just oozes both sensuality and charisma, played by the incredibly wonderful Marina Baccarin, previously of Firefly fame. The Resistance, instead of being led by a reporter and a scientist, now has a counter-terrorist agent by the name of Erica Evans, played by Elizabeth Mitchell, and, of all things, a priest named Father Jack Flannery.
What a brilliant move. I mean, this opens up a whole new can of worms for this show. Not only are we dealing with the political ramifications, but we're dealing with the religious ramifications of aliens coming onto Earth. If we see aliens, does that mean God doesn't exist? Does that mean aliens are part of God's plan? And we really watch this priest go through crisis of faith and how he deals with it. And I think it's absolutely brilliantly handled.
Yeah, the whole aspect of how religion is affected by this is wonderful. And again, it's a good reflection back on 9/11. Shortly after the events of 9/11, churches all over the United States suddenly found their attendance skyrocket through the roof because people were looking for an answer. Why did this happen? And seeking the security of faith in a time of crisis. There is a great scene right after the Visitors arrive where the head priest is talking to Jack, and he basically says, well, I don't think this is going to have much of an effect on us. And the two of them walk out into the church area and find it packed, whereas before there were a handful of people in the pews. It's just packed to the gills because people want to know, where do we go from here? Where are answers? And that was just a wonderful statement, in my opinion.
I have to agree. And even though the character is a Catholic character, I think that this is showing...
It has a wonderful universal feel to it. It's not just the Catholic Church. It could be a Jewish synagogue. It could be a Pentecostal congregation. It could be a Muslim mosque.
And that's really the point, is it saying that when you see something like this, when it shakes your faith, you come back home.
And one of the other things that came up interesting about Father Jack in the original four episodes is that he's not just your average priest who's decided to join a resistance. he actually has military background to him. So they're not just taking your run-of-the-mill person and saying, oh, here you go. Much like everybody in Hollywood, you know how to shoot a gun. They're saying, no, he actually has a military background, and he knows how to handle himself. But there are some very distinct comparisons and contrasts that can be made between the new series and the old series. For instance, the new series removes a lot of the cheesy aspects of the show. While the uniforms had their place being a representation of the Nazi occupation, by today's standards, they are really cheesy. Heck, even by the 1980s standards, they were a bit cheesy. The fact that the aliens used to all walk around wearing sunglasses because their lizard eyes were sensitive to our sun, it was cheesy. And fortunately, Scott Peters has managed to get rid of that.
And when you really think about it, the eyes that the visitors were looking through were like false eyes anyways. So wouldn't you build in the sunglasses to the false eyes?
We can do it now. This time around, the visitors had infiltrators that had arrived on Earth and become part of society long before the official arrival. There are sleeper agents within the new series.
That's actually kind of an important point, as they just didn't land and take over. They came here, they studied, they have done everything they can to get people into positions of power or authority, and then they show up.
It also does wonders in providing a question that was never really a question before, and that is the person I'm talking to actually a human being, or are they a visitor in disguise? I have a feeling that if this show manages to survive the onslaught of ABC, I think it has a great potential of introducing new characters and having that be a reoccurring question. Is this somebody I can trust? Is this somebody that I can't trust? Are they a visitor in disguise? Again, a great aspect in the first couple of episodes that I would love to see them continue to pursue. One aspect of the new show that has a little bit of a cringe factor to it is the fact that the counter-terrorist agent's son is being seduced by the visitors. He's being offered involvement in their elite group, much like Mike Donovan's son did in the original series. And he's kind of establishing a relationship with Lisa, who is one of the visitor officers and Anna's daughter. It creates a little bit of fear of that whole Starchild thing that we were talking about before, with him becoming the new Robin, and no, not the Boy Wonder. But like I said, I have high hopes that Scott Peters can manage to steer clear of the Starchild fiasco. There is a reporter involved in the storyline by the name of Chad Decker, only this time he seems to be helping the aliens, at least for now.
He definitely has his own agenda. When it matches up with the aliens, he is on their side.
When they stand in the way of his agenda, he really doesn't have any problem in throwing them under the bus, as it were. And then you have the character of Ryan Nichols, who is one of the aforementioned infiltrators / sleeper agents, played by Morris Chestnut. And while on the surface there are vague similarities to Willie in the fact that he's willing to work with the Resistance and is in a relationship with a human female who is pregnant, but he is far more competent than Willie ever was. Willie was there more as a comic relief, whereas Ryan Nichols is probably going to prove to be a significant character.
Yeah, they have already mentioned that he has a backstory, and I have a feeling it's going to be a very interesting story.
He's yet another one of those characters that you think you can trust him, but you don't quite know for sure. So, by the way you've been hearing me talk about this, you can probably tell that I've really enjoyed the 4 episodes that have come out so far. Which is yet another kiss of death for it, but that's just me being pessimistic.
Yes, I would give it 3.5 pens in the pocket protector. I think this is just an incredibly well-written show, well-directed, well-acted, really high-end effects. Everything that I look forward to in a show. I'll be buying the complete series on DVD when it's released next month.
In comparison to the original miniseries, I would say that it's definitely on a par with it, if not maybe just a little bit better, to be honest. That might be because I'm looking at it through different eyes. When the original V miniseries came out, like I said, I was 13 years old. It's kind of a skewed point of view. Yes, I've bought the DVDs since they've come out in the past couple of years, And I look at it now and I go, wow, that's really cheesy. But then again, what TV show in the 1980s wasn't a little bit cheesy?
It's so weird because I think it's an unfair comparison. To look at the 1983 miniseries, you have to look at it through 1983 eyes. And when I really look at it and I think about what people could get away with saying on television, what types of actions the characters could do, the level of violence, I joke about the A-Team in the opening today. But every single person on the A-Team always carried guns, the villains always had guns, and how many people died? Only one of the main characters on the show was ever actually shot. And you look at V, the miniseries, people got shot, people got killed. There was tense sexual ideas, like an alien and a human making love. I mean, this was like really cutting edge at the time. Now, granted, when you look at this 2010 eyes,
we are far more jaded now.
I agree with that completely. We look at the level of violence and go, oh, that's a rated G video game violence. We look at the language and it's ridiculous to us because people don't talk like that. That's Beaver Cleaver talk. Looking at it through this set of eyes, it's really a different show. But if you think about it as a historical piece, I'm very impressed with the special effects, with the acting, with the writing. And I think V the Miniseries is definitely a 4-star show through those eyes. When you go back and revisit it, maybe it's a 3-star show. But having seen it that original time, it's a different show.
And along those lines, 20 years from now, we might look back at the new series and go, oh man, that was so sugar-coated. You know, I don't see anybody's head exploding and...
Nobody was vivisected.
There wasn't a single piece of brain matter that ended up on the camera. What's the deal with that?
Yes. But V, the 2009 series through 2010 eyes, I love it just as much as I did V, the original miniseries. Again, I think the writing is brilliant. Casting couldn't be more perfect. I don't think there's anybody on the show that's a standout A-list big blockbuster movie actor. But every single person on this show is known for something. We're not talking a cast of nobodies. It's probably one of my top series of the 2000s.
Any show that can make Laura Vandervoort, who was previously known as Kara Zor-El on Smallville, anyone who can make her look like a professional actress, they're good.
That's all in the CGI budget, though. I can see that. You know what? We're going to get somebody who can really act, and then we're just going to use the CGI to paste Laura Vanderhoort's face on it.
The part of Lisa is actually played by Meryl Streep.
I suppose my number two biggest complaint about this television show is it landed on ABC. This show would be a top-rated hit on the Sci-Fi Channel. I don't know where it is on ABC, but it's not in that hit status.
When V debuted on November 3rd, 2009, it had incredibly high ratings. It was one of the highest rated premieres of the season. Those ratings, though, quickly shrunk over the next 3 weeks. We're not talking losing 10-20%. We're talking losing 50%, and then 50% of that, just in a matter of a couple of weeks. The question that I have on the surface of that, though, is most people already knew that they were only going to show 4 episodes before it went into hiatus. And how much of the drop is related to the fact that they knew they were only going to get 4 episodes before it went into a 5-month hiatus? How many people just didn't want to get involved in a show that they knew wasn't going to be on in a month?
I don't know how much that affected it. I think that was just an incredibly jackass maneuver for them to make. Just call it a mid-season replacement and forget about it.
Yeah, ABC is now claiming, after the fact, that they always intended the first 4 episodes to air completely separate from the rest of it, almost as if a standalone miniseries. To me, that sounds a lot like Monday morning quarterbacking. We've made this decision, now we need to find a reason to explain it. I agree with you. To put a show on and then put it on hiatus for 5 months has got to be one of the biggest boneheaded moves that I've seen a network make in a very long time.
And we see this every year. This is not something that's a new occurrence. You have a show like Lost, number one show of the season, incredible ratings, week after week, climbing ratings. Show ends its season, there's a 3-month break for summer, and all of a sudden, only half the people come back to watch it. Show like Heroes, standout show, got better ratings, more successful than anybody thought it was going to be. Goes off the air for 3 months for summer, comes back, half the people come back to watch it. They know this happens.
So why set yourself up, not with a season under your belt, but just 4 episodes? Do you really expect an audience to stick around just for 4 episodes and to come back after only having committed to 4 episodes 5 months later? It's asking too much of your typical audience. And I really feel like it's almost like sabotaging their own show.
I agree with that 100%. I do want to give credit to whoever is doing the publicity at ABC right now. I have seen a lot of ads for the return of the show.
Yeah, and again, to somebody's credit, hopefully it's whoever stepped in and said, do you realize what kind of a boneheaded move this was? They are doing advertising. They are going to be showing a recap episode the Tuesday before the show officially comes back to help get people caught up with where the show is going to pick up at. That's going to be called V, The Arrival, and it aired March 23rd on ABC. So I honestly felt like the Bionic Woman got cheated due to the writer's strike. I don't feel as though it really got a fair shake because of the fact that halfway through its airing, it got shut down. I can't really explain what happened to Knight Rider because I don't think it was a bad show. The only thing that I can think of is that it wasn't the original Knight Rider, and therefore people were finicky enough to go, well, this isn't what I'm used to for Knight Rider, so I'm not going to watch it. There always seems to be an extenuating circumstance, and I really hope that ABC hasn't built in that extenuating circumstance by doing this 5-month hiatus. At the same time, I'm afraid that they've already built in this fatal flaw that's going to get this show canceled due to poor ratings because of the 5-month hiatus. So, V will be returning from its hiatus to ABC's lineup March 30th, 2010. How long V will actually last remains to be seen. Honestly, I really hope that we're wrong. I just don't have very high hopes that it will.
Sci-Fi Channel executives, if you are listening to this, please watch V the series. This would go great in your new lineup for 2010-2011.
Much better than the 20,000 reality shows that you have currently booked.
You can cancel Stargate Universe, you could cancel Sharktopolis, and any other original miniseries you have on the plans. I have the tools for Sci-Fi Channel success. No more Sci-Fi Channel original movies.
I remember when Sci-Fi Channel first came out, and they aired nothing but old sci-fi shows that got canceled. And I completely understand the idea of wanting to broadcast new, never-before-seen stuff. But actually listen to the fans once in a while and maybe go around and go, oh, you don't want V the series? Oh, we'll take it. We'll produce that show. Not a problem. Oh, you don't want Dollhouse? Oh, we'll take it. We'll scoop it up. Because as I said before, ratings that will get a show canceled on network television are going to be blockbuster numbers on a cable channel. On a cable show, 5 million viewers is outstanding numbers. If you only get 5 million viewers on a network show, it's considered a failure. Take the failure and make a success out of it.
And also, my second note to Sci-Fi Channel executives, I'd rather go back to the olden days. I would really rather enjoy the reruns of Manimal and Automan rather than new episodes of Scare Tactics.
Now, before we wrap things up, last episode was our annual Oscar cast, and as per usual, we want to do a very quick wrap-up of that. Congratulations to Doug Zeitlin, who managed to go 7-for-7, a perfect score for the Oscar picks. Unfortunately, the one point that we disagreed on, he beat me on.
When it comes to going 7-for-7, I wish it were Playboy Bunnies and not the Oscar picks, but whatever.
If you're going to do 7 of anything, you'd rather do 7 of 9?
Yes. Yes, I would. As always, we appreciate you listening to TorpCast, and we encourage your feedback. Please write jim@torponline.net. We can also be found on Zanga, Facebook, and MySpace.
You've been listening to a broadcast of Timewell Electronic Recording Productions, copyright 2010. Thanks for listening, everybody. Dun, 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 dun.